Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Pennsylvania has led the nation in the number of Lyme disease cases diagnosed for the past 7 years. More than a third of all Lyme is in Pennsylvania. Spread through the bite from a deer tick, Lyme is treated most effectively if caught early. But that's not always the case, and long-term treatment is often not covered by insurance. Legislation has been proposed in Pennsylvania that would expand insurance coverage for the treatment of Lyme. On today's program, we're joined by Republican State Representative Kathy Rapp of Warren County. Representative Rapp, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.
Also, to be here. Jackie Zulli, Vice President of Legislative Affairs for the Pennsylvania Lyme Resource Network. Ms. Zulli, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Dr. Henry Linder, who is an endocrinologist and has a personal stake in this, is in that his daughter was diagnosed with Lyme disease. Dr. Linder, want to welcome you to the program as well.
Thank you very much.
If you have a question or a comment, I know you do because this is a topic that gets a lot of response. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. And I do encourage you to get your phone calls in early because later in the program, we're going to be talking with someone from the Pennsylvania Insurance Federation about their opposition to the bill. So, I encourage you to get your phone calls in early, emails in early. So, Jackie Zulli, let me start with you. Why is there a need to expand the length of time that insurance covers the treatment of Lyme disease?
Well, as an attorney, I had never really contemplated being involved in legislation. In fact, I had tried to steer clear of it. My first love is working with children, and I was a lead juvenile prosecutor in York County. I came down with Lyme disease myself that almost killed me, and I realized that there was an issue going on here. I treated it just like a court case, parsed through all the information, and the facts led me to the information being inaccurate that insurance was following for coverage of the disease. The legislation is very important because it's going to do exactly what legislators are supposed to be doing. They're supposed to right a wrong. And in Lyme disease, they're not looking to have a new type of insurance coverage. They're looking to simply have Lyme disease treated like all other diseases, and in the various stages of Lyme disease, have insurance coverage, not just for the beginning stage. We don't do that to cancer. We don't just say if we haven't caught it at stage one, you know, then it's post-treatment cancer and we're not going to cover further treatment. So we're just looking to have Lyme disease be covered like any and every other disease. And the legislation does simply that. It puts the ability for a doctor to clinically diagnose and treat right in their hands like it should be.
Dr. Linder, let me turn to you. Your daughter was diagnosed with Lyme disease. Tell us her story. What happened?
Well, when she was 10 years old, I found two ticks on her ear and her neck. I removed them. They were partially engorged. I looked at the current IDSA guidelines at the time, and it said that if there was no rash and if the person seemed fine for a month afterwards, there was no need to give any kind of antibiotic prophylaxis. And so I just watched her. She seemed fine. But then over the following year, she started to become very depressed, negative, even kind of suicidal at the age of 14, and essentially tried to live a normal life but just kept going downhill. And then 14 years after this, I eventually, she had no signs or symptoms of any clear infectious disease, but 14 years later, I started to think it could be possible that it was causing her problems. And testing has since confirmed that she has both Bartonella and Babesia, which can also be acquired through ticks, Bartonella through other means also.
Yeah, that's so one thing that we want to point out on the program today, that when we're talking about tick-borne illnesses, it is not just Lyme disease. In fact, former U.S. Senator Kay Hagan died within the past week from a tick-borne illness. But Dr. Linder, what you described, though, depression and some of those other symptoms, a lot of young people go through that. What made you suspect that it could be Lyme?
Well, she had severe fatigue also, and one day I was talking to her, and she told me that that every single emotion she felt actually became painful. And I realized this couldn't be just some sort of strange psychological disorder. She even couldn't have a conversation with people, or she'd be, you know, wiped out and couldn't do any homework or other work for the rest of the day. And so these kind of facts, which I really didn't get from her earlier on in her disease, made me finally suspect there must be some sort of inflammation or other process affecting her brain.
Now, are you saying that those symptoms did not show up in the ensuing 14 years?
She did become, like, after about 2-3 years, we saw that she was very depressed and anxious and thought that she couldn't function as well as she could. But what she has are these vascular infections with Babesia and Bartonella, and they can be much more subtle than Lyme disease. And so she just got progressively worse, and I eventually got all this information out of her when she just couldn't function any longer. She tried to be normal as long as she could.
So how is she doing today, and how is she being treated?
Today she is still in a very bad state. It was only, we treated her for Bartonella for about 5 months, when even at that time we still could see Bartonella bacteria in her blood. A physician who used a fish test, which lights up the bacteria in the blood. But only recently we discovered she has this Babesia infection also, Babesia duncani. And this testing was positive, Igenics this time. A fish test identified it in her blood directly. But it was negative when I first had her tested a year and a half ago. And this illustrates another problem, that tests often will not be positive when the disease is present. These organisms know how to suppress the immune response to themselves. That's why how they stay in people.
Mm. So, Representative Rapp, let me turn to you. You are one of the main sponsors of this legislation. Let me ask you this. What would the legislation actually do?
Well, I am the prime sponsor for the House version, House Bill 629. Listening to the other guest, and every legislator has constituents in their district suffering from tick-borne illnesses, and they're struggling to find a specialist who can diagnose and accurately treat. Unfortunately, when they go for treatment, some insurance companies are denying coverage of whatever treatment the doctor recommends beyond that 28 days of antibiotics or whatever. So House Bill 69, it does the following. It permits healthcare practitioners to diagnose and prescribe antibiotic therapy for a duration that they deem appropriate upon making a diagnosis, not based on what current insurance coverage is. But they are also required to disclose all risks, benefits associated with that treatment. It has to be recorded in a patient's medical record. But it requires health insurers to provide the coverage for long-term antibiotic and antimicrobial therapy for a patient with Lyme disease and related tick-borne illnesses when it's been determined by a healthcare practitioner to be medically necessary, and it's ordered by the healthcare practitioner after making a thorough evaluation and coming up with a diagnosis. But if I could just back up a little bit, in 2014, the General Assembly passed Act 83, which developed a task force to look at Lyme disease and to look at the gaps in treatment, diagnosis, and through all of this, we looked at funding for a research lab, which is now at East Stroudsburg University. Anyone or a physician who finds a tick on a patient or an individual, they can send that tick into the university, and the university can research lab can determine whether or not that tick is carrying any tick-borne illnesses. So the legislation has really come out of listening to our constituents and listening to the task force and people from all over the state of the roadblocks in treating Lyme and other tick-borne illnesses.
Okay, so let me move on to the next step here. Now, under normal circumstances, now I'm going to address this to you, Ms. Oakley. Under normal circumstances, when legislators hear there are a lot of people who are suffering and they're not covered by insurance, facing big bills, it would seem to be an easy vote for them. But the circumstances are different with Lyme. In that the Pennsylvania Medical Society, you say that they are neutral, but they have in the past opposed this. The Centers for Disease Control, Infectious Disease Association, also oppose similar bills because there seems to be a disagreement amongst the medical community. One of the big reasons is because a lot of doctors look at this and say that you do not want to prescribe antibiotics more than what you need to because, number one, there are side effects. Number two, that the immune system can become resistant to antibiotics. What do you say to that, Jackie Zulli?
Okay, well, so as an attorney, I like to tease through things and just stick really close to facts. So the arguments against this bill are simply all inaccurate. The two options when someone gives you a reason in opposition to this bill, including the reasons that you just gave, show that they are either unfortunately ignorant or deceitful. And so whenever someone says those kind of comments like that it's long-term unsafe, that there's...
But why would they be deceitful?
I wouldn't know. I never, even as a prosecutor, you know, intent is not always something that people give out. I do know that there's big business, and so potentially, you know, they are misinformed and think that, you know, they'll either lose money paying for additional antibiotics. But, you know, that's not for us to know. We just need to know that what they're saying when they say that long-term antibiotics are unsafe is that is either an ignorant statement or a deceitful statement. Because when you look through the facts, the medicine, and the law, you find out that, you know, even a piece of food can become unsafe. So that's something for a physician and a patient to decide the risks and benefits based on their medical position. Antibiotics have been out for a very, very long time. They have been one of the most studied medicines that is out there. And we certainly don't stop people from taking biologics, which can cause sudden death and stroke. So I just look at that as muddying the water, so to speak.
But you're talking about doctors, you're talking about scientists, people who are basing their opinions on, I mean, the Centers for Disease Control would seem to have no motivation to say this is not a safe way to go.
Well, I would just say that they're probably ignorant then, because when you look through the different studies that have been done and you see that, you know, there is some potential flaws to the way that the studies were designed and then how they were utilized to give out information. I mean, as far as long-term goes, they looked at actually a short-term usage and called it long-term. So you have to be very careful that you're not using your information, fast and loose, so to speak. And so that's where I say, when you tease through all of this information, you realize that the four corners of this bill does not legislate medicine. It doesn't tell doctors or healthcare practitioners what to do. It just says that it simply should be the doctor or healthcare practitioner doing the clinical diagnosis and the clinical treatment, and that, you know, the insurers are not supposed to be doing that either. Once something is not experimental, which they like to say it is, it's simply not. Experimental is a legal term of art, and they're using it, and the layperson thinks it means something else. And so if they are using it, they shouldn't be, because it's either ignorant or deceitful on their part. It should not be anyone except for the healthcare practitioner making the diagnosis, deciding the treatment. Once something's at a second school of thought, then the insurer should be covering it.
Representative Rapp, does that give you any pause when you have organizations of medical professionals? And by the way, this is not all medical professionals, but that there are a group of them that say that this is not the way to go.
With any piece of legislation that is somewhat controversial, we always try to listen to both sides of the issue, and as legislators, and what I I stated on the floor of the House in the debate was this bill really puts the patient and the doctor in with that doctor diagnosing and giving the treatment without the patient having to worry about the insurer being in the middle. And so we were hit hard and major pushback from the insurers when we passed the bill in the House. So in my opinion, and what I said on the floor was to the members of the House, this is a bill where you're going to either stand on the side of our constituents who are suffering from Lyme and tick-borne illnesses, or are we going to stand with the insurers? And many, many bills, there are many, many different sides. So in this case, that was my conclusion. Am I going to stand with my constituents suffering with Lyme? And am I going to stand between them and their physician, or was I going to stand with the insurers? And I think I did not want to get in the middle of that doctor-patient relationship, and I think we need to remove that pressure from the insurers. And so that's where I have to stand, is representing my constituents.
All right. Thank you very much for that. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. You can see some of the shows we're working on in the future on Smart Talk by going to our website, WITF.org/smarttalk. The latest Franklin and Marshall poll will be out tomorrow. We'll be talking about it on Friday. There's a new book about James Buchanan and his relationship with his fellow senators and legislators, politicians in the 1830s all the way up through the 1860s. That's coming up next week. And NPR's Noel King will also be with us. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. Today we're talking about Lyme disease, particularly legislation that would force insurance companies to expand coverage to cover Lyme disease treatment long-term under the orders of a doctor. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@WITF.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Our guest today, Jackie Zulli, Vice President of Legislative Affairs for the Pennsylvania Lyme Resource Network, Republican State Representative Kathy Rapp, and Dr. Henry Linder, who's an endocrinologist. His daughter also suffers from tick-borne illness. 1-800-729-7532. Let's go to Tina in Mechanicsburg. Tina, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott. Good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to mention about the paradox between coverage of doxycycline for acne and Lyme disease. I was on doxycycline for acne for over a year and a half as a teenager. And again, I was on it for Lyme disease just a few years ago. And I'm living proof that long-term antibiotics are healing and are not hurtful. The American Academy of Dermatology reports that usually doxycycline is needed for 3 to 4 months. However, some people will need it longer, and they leave it up to the doctor and patient, and then it's covered by insurance. However, with Lyme disease, it's denied.
Tina, thank you very much for your call. I get the gist of it. Jackie Zulli, what about what Tina has to say? I know that is one of the resource network. That is one of the points that you make in response to this, is that, to support it, I should say, is that there are other illnesses, other conditions where antibiotics are prescribed for long term.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly antibiotics, like I said, have been around for decades and have a very, very good record for safety. We know the potential risks. There are things people can do to alleviate them. Peptic ulcer disease is a very great, you know, comparison, because initially everyone just thought it was something that, you know, middle-aged men were really getting sick from just all their overwork. And it turns out it was a bacteria. It turns out it takes multiple antibiotics to cure. And it also takes a length of time to be determined by the patient's symptoms. symptoms disappearing. So, you know, why would Lyme disease be treated any differently than any other disease? There really isn't any reason. In fact, the current insurer guidelines that are now actually removed, there aren't any. They're working on new ones. They really had no actual reason to pick the amount of treatment time that they were paying for. Upon any study, there was no proof besides patients, many of them becoming asymptomatic, but that still leaves out about 30% of the patients, but they can't point to one thing saying that for certain the bacteria is gone from a short course of antibiotics, even in an acute diagnosis situation.
You know, it's probably whenever we do this, and the gist of our program today, the focus is on this bill and insurance. But whenever we're talking about Lyme disease, I think it is wise to talk about some of the symptoms, because one of the keys here is that if someone is diagnosed early, if you catch Lyme disease early on, there is a much better success rate of it being treated successfully, maybe in just a few weeks, than if it is not diagnosed and it goes on for a longer time. So what kind of symptoms are we talking about, Jackie?
So it's very interesting, because bacteria such as this, and in the initial stages of it going out the body, some people tend to have a flu-like symptom with a few of those symptoms that you have with the flu, sometimes gastrointestinal missing. You can have fever, you can have lethargy, you just feel really, really bad, and then it goes away after a weekend. Some people exhibit Bell's palsy. It's been going on a little bit further by the time you reach that stage. But the key thing is, if in the middle of summer you have a summer flu, that should give you pause for thought for Lyme disease. And so as the disease progresses, you know, varying other symptoms can emerge. And there's a lot of idiopathic diagnoses that talk about different symptoms. But what's interesting is a lot of those, when you look and dig deeper for the root, it's coming out that, you know, Lyme disease should be considered. In particular, one that's making the news right now is Alzheimer's. And famous singer Kris Kristofferson had been actually to the point where he was homebound and no longer touring. Turns out it was the Lyme bacteria that was causing his Alzheimer, and he was treated and toured this summer. So there's just so many different ways it can exhibit itself, because it doesn't stay in your blood. It goes to your organs. It goes to your joints. It can go to your brain. That you really, living in Pennsylvania, want to always, I guess, be thinking, if you ever leave your house and you've seen any type of little critters in your yard, that you could be encountering a tick which carries Lyme.
And there will be those who will say that with climate change, there will be more ticks, correct?
People are saying that, and it's actually been, you know, good for Lyme disease conversation, because the ticks do not, you know, suffer when it's warm. They love it. The ticks are actually, for hunters out there, they don't die in the wintertime. They actually can survive sub-zero temperatures. So once it's 32 or above, they're out crawling. So if, in fact, you know, and I don't really know a ton about climate change, but if, in fact, that is accurate, that will just lead to ticks, you know, being able to even get around more frequently.
Representative Rapp, so what happens with this legislation? As you said, it made it out of committee. House voted on it. Where does Governor Wolf stand on it, and will it become law?
I do believe that the Department of Health, because would support this, which is part of the governor's administration, and under the Department of Health's line item in 2018, we gave $2.5 million for Lyme disease, and we've given $500,000 for East Stroudsburg University for their research lab, and then another $500,000 from the Department of Health. So currently, the bill has passed the House. It was not an easy lift. There was a lot of lobbying by the insurers. In the Senate, unfortunately, it is was referred to Senate Banking and Insurance. So I was disappointed, very disappointed, to see the bill referred, both the Senate bill and the House bill, being referred to Senate Banking and Insurance. I would have preferred that the Health Committee pass it to go straight to the floor, but unfortunately that did not happen.
I want to have to wrap up this portion of the program because we are going to be talking with the Insurance Federation in just a moment. Republican State Representative Kathy Rapp, Jackie Zilley, Vice President of Legislative Affairs for the Pennsylvania Lyme Resource Network, Dr. Henry Linder, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Coming up now, we're going to talk with Sam Marshall, President and CEO of the Insurance Federation of Pennsylvania. Joining us is, I want to make sure that we do have everyone here. Let me see. I'm sorry, we set this up at the last minute, and I can't get the name of who else is joining us?
Jonathan Greer.
Jonathan Greer with the Insurance Federation of Pennsylvania as well. All right. So, gentlemen, we just heard from those who support this legislation. Sam Marshall, let me start with you. Why does the Insurance Federation of Pennsylvania oppose this bill?
A couple of reasons. I mean, first, on the broad perspective, we don't believe that the state, that the General Assembly should say this medical treatment is good or this medical treatment is bad. And that's what the bill effectively does in saying that insurance coverage is mandatory, that insurers are mandated to cover long-term antibiotics for Lyme. That's a decision that we believe is best left to the medical professionals, not to the legislature. Generally in the world of health mandates, and we've dealt with a number of them over the years, they're reserved for care that's generally accepted among the provider community, but for whatever reason, not covered among insurers. This bill is different. This would legislatively mandate coverage of a course of treatment that, according to many of the experts, including the CDC, which is sort of the chief expert in this area, is deemed to be a dangerous and certainly controversial course of treatment. Don't think that's wise to do. Appreciate our being on the call, but from listening to the past portion, the group that should really be on is, for instance, the Center for Disease and Control and Prevention. Let the medical professionals, let the scientists have at it and come up with a consensus.
Well,
that's generally what we cover.
Let me read just a couple emails that I've received from some of the listeners, too, that bring up some of the points that they have. And that is that one says the insurance companies are slowly cherry-picking the diseases they are choosing to cover. Since the diagnostics for Lyme has been painted as questionable in terms of the various ways Lyme expresses itself, what influence does the insurance companies have on the overall treatment of Lyme? Does corporate money hinder the general treatment of Lyme? And I'll just follow that up by saying that, we did have a caller there who talked about, and it is true, that there are long-term antibiotic treatments for acne, for example, and for other illnesses. Do you cherry pick?
No, we don't. And we don't do it by practice, and we don't do it by law. Insurance can be, we do cover Lyme disease. We cover the treatment that the medical community in total says is the right and safe, effective treatment. One of the things that I think had come out on the call is a much greater need for quick, accurate testing and early treatment, early intervention, early awareness. We're certainly a part of that. That's something that the health department is doing, insurance companies are doing, communities are doing, and that's a good thing. This is not a matter of money. I mean, insurance is the ultimate pass-through. I mean, we cover what we cover, and then we charge policyholders for that coverage. This is a matter of insurance. Insurance is meant to cover that which is medically necessary, medically appropriate, medically proven. That for long-term antibiotics in the dosages and the amounts given for Lyme disease, it just, with all respect to the group that was on the call, that's not the mainstream community. That's why we've said, here, let's hear from the broader mainstream community. Let's hear from the CDC. Let's hear from the infectious disease chiefs at places like Penn or Hershey or Hopkins or UPMC. Bring in that portion of the medical community because there are real dangers. And I'm not a doctor, but I, from looking at the research, there are real dangers to long-term antibiotics at the dosages that people would prescribe in Lyme disease.
But, okay, you say that, there is some disagreement, and no doubt, Centers for Disease Control, Infectious Disease Society, at one time the Pennsylvania Medical Society opposed. But there still is a segment of doctors who are saying that this can go on long-term. We had the gentleman who said his daughter, that he had symptoms show up, and not of Lyme, but of a tick-borne illness years later. And there's no doubt that there are people who are suffering. I had another email here from a woman named Sarah, says, I suffered long-term Lyme disease. I lost all my insurance, and now I'm on disability. This cost taxpayers money.
And the question, the challenge is, I mean, appreciating that, yes, there can be long-term Lyme disease. The question is whether long-term antibiotics are a correct cure. That's not something that, frankly, the insurance company should decide. It's something that the medical community should decide. And that's where you bring in outfits like the CDC. You bring in the broader medical community. I don't think it's particularly productive to say that the CDC is ignorant, as was on the last portion, because I don't think it is. I mean, if it is, then it ought to be, it ought to be brought to task on that.
Mm-hmm.
And that ought to be shown. But I think one of the things that we have said is if you do want there to be long-term antibiotics, and I think there are a lot of dangers, and I appreciate Representative Rapp talking about there ought to be real disclosure on it. One of the things that we've said is that if you're going to do that, have the prescriptions issued then only by a board-certified, and it's board-certified by the licensure boards, by insurance companies or anything, but have that, have those long-term antibiotics be prescribed only by board-certified infectious disease specialists. Let it be the real experts in the field.
All right, let's take a phone call from Eric in Lewisburg. Eric, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. The question I had was just more informed by the comment that your insurance lobbyist just made. I've had Lyme for 10 years, and it's affected and altered my life in ways that I wish on no one. And the inability to get proper treatment and then insurance coverage. And I mean, it's just a financial burden like you cannot imagine. I think it's disingenuous when someone from the insurance lobbyist says, let's hear from the CDC. Let's hear from the infectious disease. Let's let the medical experts weigh in. The challenge and the problem with that is that it is the infectious disease doctors, the IDSA, that wrote the guidelines. The CDC have the guidelines in place since 2006. The guidelines are ancient. Lyme is such a complex, evolving medical science that the direction that it's going, it really requires people in the field, doctors, licensed practitioners in the field, to use their best judgment. And one of the most recent studies that I've recently read, it actually shows the majority of doctors are prescribing long-term. So they're going against the guidelines. The doctors in the field are actually using their best judgment. They are prescribing long-term antibiotics, but they're not getting covered by the insurance companies. And I really think the insurance lobby, I think they're kind of buttering their bread on one side for money and influence. It really is disingenuous. It's really hurting constituents.
All right. Thank you very much for your call, Mr. Marshall or Mr. Greer. Would you like to respond to that, Mr. Greer?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Thank you, Scott. Your previous caller from Lewisburg has been afflicted by Lyme disease. So too have I. I have the unique perspective of representing the insurance industry and having been a Lyme disease patient. My case was probably what would be called a textbook case, where I developed a bullseye rash and all the symptoms that go with the illness. And I was put on a 28-day course of, I think it was doxycycline, and thankfully made a complete recovery. The reason I mention that is that we do understand the seriousness of the illness. We respect the passion that has been expressed on the call and previously. But I want to just reiterate one point and say something else. We have never argued the cost issue here. That has never been our point in contention here. What we have said is that unless and until the medical community reaches a consensus on the efficacy of this treatment and it's no longer dangerous, that's got to be a problem. The problem is not with insurers. I think a lot of the animus that's directed at the insurance industry is misdirected, because what we cover is what the medical community determines to be of safe and effective. And so if the medical community at some point in time says long-term antibiotics are safe and effective, then our coverage will change with those changes. So the problem is not with us. I think the problem is within the medical community to come up with a consensus on this. And I just want to reiterate something that Sam Marshall said earlier, is that the medical community is overwhelmingly, at least as today, and against the use of long-term antibiotics. We mentioned the CDC. There are more than a dozen well-regarded organizations that say, one, it's not proven, and two, it's potentially dangerous. You can actually hurt someone by prescribing long-term antibiotics. And unless and until that changes, our position will not change.
Well, let me just bring this up. I'm not going to do a tit-for-tat kind of thing, but using the example that others have used about long-term antibiotic prescriptions to treat other illnesses like acne. So what about that? I mean, there seems to be examples where antibiotics are prescribed long-term.
We just heard that the acne example was one that we heard for the first time last week. So we don't know a lot about, we haven't dug into that side of the question, but I think it's safe to say that if we are covering long-term antibiotics for acne, that is because the medical community has determined that it is safe and effective to do so under the supervision of a doctor. And unfortunately for Lyme disease, for the Lyme disease advocates, that has not happened for Lyme disease. So there's, you know, it's not tit for tat, it's apples and orange. It's a different kettle of fish altogether.
Let me ask you this. Will premiums rise if this legislation is enacted?
This is Sam Marshall here. That's, as Jonathan has said, this is not a cost issue. Would there be some increase? And anytime you expand coverage, yes. The question is, would there be, that's not always a bad thing, if the increase in what you're covering produces better results. That's the challenge here. You want it to produce better results. That's not an issue for us. That's an issue within the medical community.
Sam Marshall, President and CEO of the Insurance Federation of Pennsylvania. Jonathan Greer is the Senior Vice President with the Insurance Federation. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Our pleasure.
For more information on Lyme disease, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross. There are several characteristics that many listeners to WITF, NPR, and public radio overall have. One is, most are curious about the world we live in. And another is, our listeners enjoy and appreciate lifelong learning. There are many programs on this station to satisfy that curiosity and the yearning for learning, but Hidden Brain, hosted by Shankar Vedantam, fits perfectly into that description, using science and storytelling to reveal the unconscious patterns that drive human behavior, shape our choices, and direct our relationships. That's what Hidden Brain is all about. I'm happy to welcome Shankar Vedantam to Smart Talk. Mr. Vedantam, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Broadest question of all. What is Hidden Brain's mission or the goals of the program?
In many ways, I think the goal of Hidden Brain is to help people understand themselves. I've often said that one of the things we try and do is we hold a mirror up to people. But this mirror is not a mirror so they can see themselves or their faces. It's a mirror for their minds. And our goal with every story is to show the world and tell people about things that are happening, but do so in a way that helps people understand their role in the world and understand how human behavior intersects with the news events that are surrounding us all the time.
Since the beginning of time, man has asked, why does something happen? Or why do we think the way that we do? Now, you try to answer those questions. How do you come up with these topics? Because I have to admit that one of the things I think about is those observational stand-up comics that pick on something that they look at it and say, did you ever think about this? But there are so many topics that we could ask why about. How do you come up with topics?
Well, in some ways, I think we do what those stand-up comics must be doing, which is they're observing the world very carefully. One of the things that's interesting, I think, is that most of us spend so much of our lives, you know, on autopilot. We're going through our lives, we're going to work, coming home, hanging out with family, but we're not actually paying attention to what's happening around us. We're not seeing it with fresh eyes. And I think one of the goals of a show like Hidden Brain is to slow down to say, if you look with curiosity at the things around you, just the everyday things around you, there are remarkable findings that are waiting to be made. There are remarkable discoveries waiting to be made. We're also, of course, deeply involved, deeply informed by the literature on these subjects. So there are hundreds of people, academic researchers around the country who are studying these questions and studying them systematically and with rigor. And what we try and do on the show is we try and marry together things that are happening in the news, things that are people are talking about at water coolers with interesting research that might shed light on those matters.
So the topics themselves, I'm sure you have a research staff, producers, but are there times when you're out in public and you see something, maybe you see it on TV, hear it on radio, or just observe it yourself and say, there would be a good topic. Why do we have to do this?
All the time. In fact, I feel like one of the blessings, I suppose, my wife might call it a curse of working on a show like Hidden Brain, is that I'm basically working all the time. And I feel like when I'm hanging out with friends or spending time at a party or even, you know, many of our best ideas come as the Hidden Brain team and I are sitting down over lunch and just talking about different issues. And sometimes we say, isn't this interesting that this came up? And then someone else says, well, I just read this in a magazine somewhere, and someone else says, you know, I saw this in a movie, and we realize there's a theme running through these different ideas. And if we step back and look at that theme, there could be an episode there. Some of our best episodes have grown out of conversations like that.
Do you have favorite topics that you've done over the years?
You know, I joke that my favorite episode of Hidden Brain is always the one that's coming out next week. And what I mean by that is partly, you know, we are so focused as a small team on building our episodes that most of our mental space is occupied by what's coming down the pike and very little is occupied by what came before. Certainly, I think we've built remarkable episodes in the past looking at all manner of different things. Some of our recent episodes have looked at the culture of outrage that permeates our social media and cable television feeds and explores why it is there's so much outrage that we see every day. An episode that I'm really looking forward to in the next few weeks is looking at end-of-life decisions. You know, we are often told to come up with advanced directives to say, here's how I would want to be treated when I'm 65 or 75 or 85, and I'm confronted with a life-threatening situation. And the theme of this episode is, do 35 and 45 and 55-year-olds really know what they themselves would want and would feel like when they're 65 or 75 or 85? In other words, can we truly tell what our future selves would want, or are those people actually completely different people than us? And so in some ways, the whole premise of advanced directives is potentially challenged.
Mm. Two shows that you did last month kind of addressed the issue of dying and fear of dying. Now, that would seem to be one of the ultimate things that humans can learn about life. Because let's face it, there is so much of our lives that are dictated by our fears and ultimately the fear of death.
Indeed. And philosophers have talked about this for centuries, which is that human beings might be unique on the planet among other species in terms of being aware of their own mortality. So all animals die, but we are cursed in that we actually know that we're going to die. We know that death is inevitable. We can actually see it coming, often at a distance of years or decades. And the question that many philosophers have asked for centuries and that many psychologists have tried to answer in more recent years is, what does that fear do to us? What is the fact that we are aware of our mortality? How does that shape our thinking? How does that shape our choices? And it turns out that when you study this carefully, the fear of mortality produces all kinds of interesting effects in our lives and manifests itself in various kinds of behavior.
Mm. Like what?
Well, one of the things that happens is that, of course, when you're afraid of death, it feels unpleasant. It feels scary. You feel, you know, you feel pretty miserable to think about death. And so human beings routinely try and find ways to avoid thinking about death. So one of the things is if we know that we're going to die and that thought basically is ever present in our minds, then that's going to affect how we go about our lives. It's going to affect the conversation that you and I are having if we actually are aware that in a few decades there are going to be two skeletons in the ground, not two people talking on the radio. And so our minds come up with all kinds of defenses to keep those fears at bay. And one of the things that's measurable in many experiments is that you can actually measure that people actually have these defense mechanisms that keep the fear of death at bay. And one of the things they do, interestingly, is they gravitate to the groups and tribes and cultures in which they're embedded. Because one of the things that our groups and tribes teach us is that in some ways they are immortal when we are not. And so when you confront people with the fear of death, one of the things that happens is that people hew more strongly to their cultural roots, to their tribes. They become more loyal to their countries and to their ethnic tribes, for example. And this is a defense mechanism in some ways to keep the fear of death at a distance.
You mentioned earlier one of your recent topics was on outrage. Obviously, this division that we have politically and even culturally in this country. One of the big questions that many people have is, how do we bring ourselves together again? How do we overcome this division that we have? What do you find? I mean, are there any answers out there?
Well, I think there are answers, but I'm not sure many people want to hear those answers. You know, sometimes late in the evening this is what I do for entertainment, but I wouldn't necessarily recommend it to other people. I try and switch channels between, you know, Fox News and MSNBC at 9 o'clock at night. And if you go back and forth between those channels, you'll find two sets of people who are completely outraged by the other side. And if you listen to just one of those channels, you'll believe the other side are just filled with monsters and despicable people. And then you switch the channel and you realize the other side feels exactly the same way as well. And this is not to say that there are not genuine and legitimate reasons why people should be outraged about things. There are absolutely things that are wrong with the world, and outrage is not only the right response, it's actually the only justifiable response to some of the things that happen. But the question is, what happens when we're surrounded by outrage to such an extent that the volume on everything seems to be turned to 11? So if I tell you to be outraged about something on Monday and something else on Tuesday and something else on Wednesday, by Thursday, understandably, a lot of people are exhausted by all of the outrage, and they basically throw their hands up and say, you know, a curse on both their houses, I'm just switching off, I can't take this anymore. One of the ways I think you try and bridge this divide is to actually do what psychotherapists do. You know, when squabbling couples come into psychotherapy, one of the goals of psychotherapy is not so much to say, you know, the disputes that you have between you are not real, because many cases the disputes are real. They're based on legitimate grievances. But the goal of psychotherapy is really to say, how do I situate these legitimate grievances you have in a larger context so that you don't think that these grievances constitute 90% of your relationship? They're still there, they still exist, they're still real, and they're still potentially unsolvable, but they're only 10% of your relationship. And in fact, on 90% of everything else, you actually agree. One of the things that I think we don't do enough of, even in the media, perhaps this is true for public radio as well, is talk about areas of commonality, because in many ways our de facto principle as members of the press is to think that issues of controversy and conflict are more interesting than issues of harmony and cooperation. But as a result of that bias, sadly, you know, we are confronted with the perception that we disagree on everything, when in fact it might actually be a relatively small number of things that we disagree about.
Mm. One final question, because we only have a short amount of time. Someone who may not have heard The Hidden Brain before. Now, I don't know who that would be if they're listening to WITF and public radio. But what would you tell them? What to expect? What kind of advice would you give? I don't know. If it's coaching them to listen, what would you say to them?
Do you mean about Hidden Brain or
yes,
about their own life?
Yes, about Hidden Brain.
Well, I would say certainly if you're listening for our show, one of the things that a lot of our listeners to the show tell us is that the show prompts them to think about their own lives. And in some ways, you know, I actually think they might not even be listening to us so much as that our stories prompt people sometimes for the first time to listen to themselves. And I think that's the hope of the show. When you listen to us, you're not just going to learn about interesting things happening in the news or interesting ideas from the academy, you will have a perception and awareness of yourself, ideally, that you did not have before.
And I think a word that you just mentioned is so key to the success and why people do love the program is story, that you use stories to make it very understandable and very relatable. Shankar Vardhanam, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Scott.